On many different perspectives and areas of inquiry. We don't ask you to believe anyone or anything. What to make of the material we present, that we leave up to you. We focus on the controversial, fringe, and the underreported, and much more. A variety of topics that we hope you can learn something from. Check out our website, redeyescreations.com, for much more of what we do. Radio, TV, news, and a growing member section. Today we're talking to Bryce Sable. He has created 5 primetime television series, including the Emmy-winning UFO conspiracy series Dark Skies. He's an American television producer, director, writer, and occasional actor. In 2008, Sable received the Writers Guild of America Award for writing his 3rd 4-hour Hallmark miniseries, Pandemic. His other series include Steven Spielberg's Taken, Atlantis, The Lost Empire, Mortal Kombat Annihilation, Blackbeard, and The Poseidon Adventure. He's been an award-winning on-air PBS investigative reporter, an adjunct professor at the USC School of Cinematic Arts, and is a member of the Directors Guild of America. More importantly, for our purposes here today, what you need to know is that Bryce is the co-author with Richard Dolan of the book AD After Disclosure, when the government finally reveals the truth about alien contact. And that is what we're going to discuss in the 2nd hour. In the 1st hour, we're going to talk about all things related to the excellent series Dark Skies. What is the truth and what is fiction about UFOs and conspiracies? Stay with us for more. Welcome to Red Eyes Radio, Bryce Sable. It's good to talk to you. We had your co-author with us, Richard Dolan. Well, that's actually over a year ago now, but it's great to have you with us finally as well. Thank you, first of all, for taking the time talking with us here today, Bryce.
It's completely my pleasure, and it's been a pleasure also working with Richard Dolan on these projects, because he, as you know, is the preeminent authority on all things UFO historical, so it's been great.
I think it's a great match, if you will, considering your past, your history. I want to talk a little bit about that here in the beginning, and then combining that with Richard's work. He comes from the documented world, if you will, and of course you have a background in sci-fi screenwriting and everything else. Let's start talking a little bit about Dark Skies, one of my absolute favorites of all times. It's a magnificent series. Can you give us a little bit of a synopsis of what that was about, Bryce?
Dark Skies was a series that here in the United States aired for 20 hours of programming back in the late 90s. And the premise of which was simply that it took place during the Kennedy administration here in the United States, and then going forward into the 60s, and sort of wove all of the historical events of the 1960s into a ufological timeline, if you will. So it had a lot of fun with the real story. It also made a lot of dramatic contributions. I never looked at it as being a journalistic endeavor. I always looked at it as a dramatic endeavor. But it allowed us to tell a overarching storyline that was premised on the basis that if Roswell was true in 1947, by the time Kennedy was taking office in 1961, it was the UFO cover-up, if you will, was still in its infancy. And it was interesting to my creative partner Brent Friedman and myself to actually see how that cover-up went from being just a military cover-up of a military event to being more of a global event that was that had the scope and the reach of so many other stories. So that's what Dark Skies was. Fortunately, it finally came out on DVD in 2011 in 2 forms. In the United States, it came out with all the extras and goodies from a Shout Factory release, and over in Europe, it came out from a company called Medium Rare. And they put all the episodes out, but they didn't have the extras and the goodies. But at least now, after a number of years, it's possible for people that want to know what the show was about and see what it was about for themselves, they get a chance to do it.
Absolutely. I highly recommend it. We have before actually on the website as well. It's so many interesting elements. I want to ask you about some of these in there, of
sure.
course. But how, first of all, how much research did you and Brent do for the series? Hours and hours and documented stuff, or did you come up with it?
Well, both. It is a heavily researched piece from two points of view. It's heavily researched into what the UFO events of that timeline was, and also what the historical timeline was, because we needed to weave the two of them together. And prior to actually producing the series, Brent and I created a very massive timeline that took we literally took Time and Newsweek magazine from the 1960s and broke them down day by day, month by month, and then we took and that was in column one of the timeline. In column two, we took ufological events that we got from books and reports and Project Blue Book and all kinds of things and put them into column two. And then when they matched up, we tried to create episodes out of them. So, for example, the New York power blackout of 1967 matched up with the death of Dorothy Kilgallen on the same night, which matched up with people thinking that UFO sightings had been associated with the power blackouts, and we made quite a nice story about it. So we did lots of research. I'm a journalist primarily from my beginnings. I started out at CNN and have become a dramatist, and so I didn't look at this as an activist piece, nor did I look at it as anything that was meant to be interpreted by anybody as the actual stone cold truth, but was obviously a dramatic interpretation of events that many people think are true.
Well, that's what I was so impressed when I watched the series, because I was interested in ufology for a long time, and I noticed that the writers at the time, who I didn't know it was you, of course, at the time when I was watching it, had really done their homework. Everything was mentioned in there, the timeline of how things indeed have played out in terms of you know, some of the aspects mentioned in Project Blue Book, and that later went on to Project Seal and onward from there. Very interesting stuff. So, and I was really impressed the way that was weaved together, the real stuff, and with some of the sci-fi aspects to it, if you will. But at the same time, I'd like to ask you about some of the ideas that are introduced in the
sure.
series, like the hive and the ganglion. I've always been very interested in that, and if you see that that's an analogy for something, or actually a real possibility, something you came across in your research, Bryce.
Okay. Again, it's almost like all of the above. The first thing I would say is thank you for your mention of how it was woven together, because that's how we looked at it. We were trying to weave real-life events with UFO events and then come up and spin our own story events out of it. So as I said, we never looked at it as being 100% the truth. We looked at it as being something that was more of a metaphor for various, you know, for various things.
Yep.
And so when you talk about the hive and the ganglion, you have to understand one thing. As a dramatist, to keep a season-long story on the air and potentially a 5-year story or 7 years, you're thinking, well, who are these people in conflict with? And so that's one of the reasons why most Hollywood presentations of extraterrestrials have to deal with invasions or nasty stuff, because Hollywood writers like myself, we need conflict, and we need villains, if you will. So that I have to separate from what you might think by looking into the you know, the truth of the matter. I think the truth of the matter is we probably know very little about who these others are that have visited us from time to time. And potentially are here right now. But for our purposes, it was all a dramatic storyline. And so the hive became, as you said, analogous, or the way I would put it is it's a metaphor. It was just something that allowed us to tell a cohesive story. So while many of the things in Dark Skies are very, very true, certainly we tried very hard to pay attention to the details and setting and design, etc. When it came time to creating the hive and how the hive operated, we had to, you know, there isn't a fact book someplace to go and where you look up on page 167 and it tells you what the aliens are like.
Right.
So those are totally creations of our own mind. Although I would say, you have to ask yourself at this point, if you believe there's been a cover up going on for 65 years, or more, you'd have to ask, well, what's the reason behind it? And it may be that there is a nefarious reason behind it and they don't want to talk about it. I mean, that's something we'll talk about when we get into the AD after disclosure, portion here. But for Dark Skies, it was simply a matter of how can we tell the most dramatic, convincing story and make it something that people who do know something about ufology can have fun watching. So, for example, even though that first episode is literally about John Kennedy being assassinated because he was going to tell the truth about UFOs in his second term, we have a very, very authentic interview with Betty and Barney Hill that takes place in that dark skies pilot.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And I think that the UFO, knowledgeable UFO researchers, et cetera, have always liked dark skies for that because we treated that part very seriously. So you have to look at the thing as a multifaceted experience, some of which is grounded entirely in the truth and some of which had to be filled in. If you think about Jurassic Park where they tried to make the dinosaurs and they had to fill in a few percent of the DNA with frog DNA, or something. I think that's how it went.
Mm.
Well, we had to do that too. We created as much of the house, as much of the dinosaur, if you will, out of what we could get out of history books and news matters. And then the rest of it we made up because we had to.
That's right. Filling in the gaps, if you will, of the story and the plausible scenarios of how things indeed played out. But who knows? Maybe it's real.
Well, you're right, Henrik. You're right. I mean, the thing is, over the years, people have said, you know, you've nailed it. That's exactly how it is. And I love to take credit for being accurate and so forth. I really can't take it there because I'm not sure that that's the case. Even going back to the Kennedy thing, the reason that we said we built the 2-hour pilot around the Kennedy assassination was simply that Brent Friedman and I, sitting in an office, out here in Hollywood, had said, well, how can we create the unified field theory of conspiracy for dramatic effect? And the way to do that, we felt, was to take the two grand conspiracies that were active in modern American culture anyway, mm-hmm. which would be the JFK assassination and the UFO cover-up, put them in an atom collider and see what happened. And what happened was dark skies.
Well, there you go. Now, pertaining to UFOs and conspiracies, were you... I don't know, maybe it's wrong to use the word believer in this case, but were you into this before you actually began writing the series? And if so, what got you into that, Bryce?
Well, I would say I'm definitely knowledgeable about the topic. I first started writing on this topic back in, I think the first script I ever wrote on the topic was back in 1988. At the time it was called Progenitor, and it became known as Official Denial when Sci-Fi Channel produced it as their first original film. And I didn't enter into anything as a believer, non-believer, anything. At that time, I just thought this would be a really good storyline, the Official Denial storyline. And so I started doing my research on it. And the more I've researched and the more books I've read, the more I say, well, there does appear to be some reality behind this, even though I think it's pretty clear that there's been a lot of fabrication, a lot of phoniness, a lot of fakery associated with this as well, but that there does seem to be a core truth to it that I responded to and thought, well, that's an excellent place to place a drama. And so starting with that Progenitor/Official Denial script, I did a couple other things, one of which was I worked with Steven Spielberg back in 1991 on a project that dealt with UFOs that never came to fruition. I also worked in 93 when I was working on Lois and Clark. I gave Clark Kent Superman kind of a ufological origin, which was fun, and had Men in Black and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And even, you know, and kept introducing the theme into other shows, but it wasn't until Brent and I sat down and came up with Dark Skies that it really became full-blown. And at that time, all of us on the staff, not just myself, but all of us, started gathering stories from friends and coworkers, et cetera, and reading widely, comparing notes. And we took it all in, and what we regurgitated out was Dark Skies, which has a lot of very close elements of truth and some that aren't so true because we were dramatists who, you have to understand, the people we were working for, Columbia Television and NBC, they were not holding us accountable to the quote-unquote truth. They simply wanted us to do a television series that would get an audience. So that seemed to be what our marching orders were, so we marched to them.
And no complaints about certain conspiracies or what have you, being too out there or something like that?
Well, honestly, Brent and I to this day shake our heads and laugh and just say, it is pretty amazing that a U.S. television network would give $45 million to a couple of guys to tell a story that was all about how history had been changed because Kennedy was killed over UFOs.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a pretty subversive storyline. And if anything, it goes to show you how little the media really is manipulated by any potential secret keepers or whatever, which is another topic that people bring up all the time. I don't really see it. I mean, no one, told us that we should do this story. No one interfered with the telling of the story on an overt way. We had a couple of incidents, but generally speaking, the people at our network and so forth, really, they were not that concerned about truth or controversy or anything. They just wanted a good show.
Interesting. Now, and to the opposite side of that, some people have suggested that the media, in effect, are advocating the phenomena, creating a new mythology and so forth as well. So maybe that would be the counter argument to the fact that they're kind of keeping the lid on things, if you know what I mean.
Well, we are creating a counter mythology, but I just don't think it's a directed one. I mean, the thing I get all the time from people, because I work in Hollywood and I've written about UFOs and now with this latest book, AD After Disclosure, people want to believe that somehow there are dark forces lurking out there who are manipulating the media and Hollywood to acclimate the public for some kind of disclosure.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
I don't buy that. I mean, it's certainly not anything that has ever happened to me, and it's certainly nothing that I've ever heard happening to any of my friends or other people who have done anything like this. And the reason I say that is they don't really need to. Hollywood is going to make alien movies whether we were manipulated or being drafted into an acclimation process or not, because people will pay box office tickets to go see them, and that's just the reality of the whole thing. So I'm not necessarily a big believer in acclimation through Hollywood, and if that ever was true, it's been accomplished. I mean, right now there's more alien movies out than ever before, and the other thing is people, like, I'll give you an example. People always think that maybe Steven Spielberg was, part of the acclimation process. Well, if he was, he's gotten some very interesting marching orders, because if you look at the filmography of Mr. Spielberg, he's done aliens from every point of view. He's had cuddly space scientists like E.T., benevolent space brothers like Close Encounters. He's done The War of the Worlds. He's doing Falling Skies, where they're very negative aliens. He's been behind MIB. I mean, he has done every version possible. So if he was taking orders from somebody or was being fed information, the message that's coming from his product is very all over the place.
It indeed is, and the doors are wide open after that, of course. And what's interesting there, it's interesting to hearing about from someone who is in the industry over in Hollywood to have that point of view as well, because sometimes it's almost taken as a granted thing that this is just what's happening in Hollywood. But again, there certainly needs to be more proof for that point of view. If so,
Hollywood. I was the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences chairman back in 2001 when 9/11 hit, and I was at a couple of meetings where. First of all, you have to understand the climate in America, post 9/11, it was pretty dramatic. And I was in a couple of meetings where the White House sent out someone to talk to people in Hollywood about how we could all sort of work together to fight terrorism and to be solid as Americans and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And at both of those meetings, any attempt by the people from Washington to say, well, maybe you could help us out a little bit, was met with a severe lack of enthusiasm.
Mm-hmm.
Hollywood does not want to work with the government in any way, shape, or form. They may want to hang out at parties that Obama comes to or something like that, but that's a far cry from being in the pocket with them. Now, there have been, and there has been, historically, some of occasions where it does look like CIA advisors were involved with Hollywood films, particularly the early films, and sometimes there are military advisors, who work for films like Battle LA and things like that, and Battleship. But those are more like to show off the technology. It's not like they're planting ideas. Those ideas were already written by somebody before those military people came on board.
Yeah, well, I've heard about the interface as well. I think the book is called Hollywood and the Pentagon, or maybe that's in reverse, and that just shows a little bit, as you said, about the military involvement, that if you have a screen a screenwriter out there working in some way together with Pentagon in order to, well, I've heard in some way to portray them in a good light, or depending on that they have their own people, basically, Pentagon,
sure,
in there to edit a little bit here and there. And if things go through from Pentagon, then they get access to a whole lot of candy that they can use later on in their productions, correct?
That's right. At the bottom of this whole argument, I just say, look, there are two issues going on here that don't necessarily have to be related. One of them is that Hollywood would make movies about aliens, and the other is that the military would influence Hollywood. It's quite easy to make movies about aliens without being influenced by anybody, because again, people want to spend their dollars to go see those kind of things because they're full of special effects and great conflict. And I mean, I don't think anybody is saying that Independence Day was based on a true story.
Yeah.
So, I just think we have to be more careful than ever, because a lot of these things that we talk about in this area, the facts are hard to come by.
It's true.
I'm very happy, actually, that I don't have to report on this as a reporter, but that I can comment on it as a dramatist. And I'm more comfortable as a dramatist than an activist, and more comfortable as a journalist than an activist, because I think these facts are, it's clear to me that somebody has some facts that we don't have, but they're hard to come by.
Yeah, we're going to get into where you see the conspiracy interface being in terms of the denial of the UFO phenomenon,
sure,
and such as well a little bit later here. But would you say, just a little bit more on this topic here, money being the primary driver in Hollywood, does that create in any regard a lack of vision, or is that what actually is pushing the envelope forward? I've heard in recent years that people think quality-wise things seems to be kind of going a little bit down the hill. And would you agree with that, if so?
Well, I don't know. I think the quality of the top films is better than ever, but like at any time in history, there's bad films and good films being made. I do think that the world economics have changed, in that just because a product, Hollywood creates a product, doesn't mean the rest of the world embraces it anymore, because many other countries are making their own good programming. And so what Hollywood has, in the feature film business, has tried to do is focus on the big blockbuster kind of things. And so they have changed the game a little bit, but only through market forces. I just wanted to throw one thing out about Dark Skies. People are going to hear that there is a movie being shot this summer called Dark Skies. And I wish so much that it was a feature film version of the series that I created with Brent Friedman, but it is not. It is a company called Dimension Films, which has decided to do an alien abduction supernatural thriller, and they have taken the name Dark Skies, and they don't really care that there was a Dark Skies before it, and I'm not real happy about it. I wish it wasn't happening, but I want to tell people, when they hear that there's a Dark Skies movie that's being shot this summer, and when it comes out next year, it is not the Dark Skies that I was behind.
Not related, not anything to do with the series. Okay, got it.
No, and it's kind of sad that they've confused the issue for everyone, because the truth is,
yeah,
there is a huge growing movement to reboot Dark Skies for,
right,
television or feature films, and there's a great Facebook page that the fans are very active on. I'd encourage people who are listening to us to go check that out. There's a Facebook page for Dark Skies. There's a Facebook page for AD After Disclosure. Both are thriving and full of people discussing things, and the people on the Dark Skies side would like to just see us finish what we started, which was, we started a story that was supposed to take us to the present day, and we only told the part of it that went from 1961 through 1967. So there is a lot more story to tell in the Dark Skies universe. And when I'm coy about certain things that are answers to your questions, it is only because I want to preserve the ability to finish telling the story in a surprising way for our fans.
Well, that's exactly. That's really good. I mean, can you imagine how much more there is to add onto that with the Phoenix lights and everything else spectacular that has happened since? You know,
it just never stops. There's so many there's so many great events that happen in the world, and there's so many ufological events that happen, and the ability to mix them together creates such a compelling piece of programming that I continue to this day to work very hard to try to figure out how to finish it. Maybe Maybe we'll have to finish it in a series of graphic novels if we can't get it on television again. Or maybe we'll get lucky. That's why I sort of resent these other filmmakers co-opting the title
yeah.
on the same topic. If they were making a thing called Dark Skies about, nighttime military observers in World War II, I wouldn't
yeah.
care. But when they're doing something about alien abductions, that does confuse the public in a way that I think is unnecessary.
Yeah, so, it muddies the water a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, it does. But then again, it just goes, I guess we can cycle back and say, but it goes to show you, you know, there is no law and order in Hollywood. People do what they want to do, and they don't take orders from anybody, and they do it their way. So that's just the way, that's the world I live in, and there's nothing much we can do about it.
All right. The Facebook page there. Facebook.com/Dark Skies UFO. We're going to have that linked up later as well.
Okay.
What do you hope to see out of the 2.0 idea, the reboot? How far can it go, do you think?
Well, I tell you, first of all, you have to understand that even though I have a vision for how I would move forward in the series, once you find a production partner who is actually funding you or would fund you, then they have a lot more input. And so anything I tell you right now would be subject to the evaluation of a funding partner because it's not cheap to make film and television. Having said that, my preference would be to literally pick up where the series left off. It left off with our main character, Lone Guard, on board one of the Hive spaceships in 1967. I'd love nothing better than to start a reboot with 1968, which had Robert Kennedy running for president and then getting murdered himself because, as you know, having seen the series, Robert Kennedy is a central character in the Dark Skies mythology. He's in, like, I believe 5 or 6 episodes out of the 20. And so he's all over the place in our show, very important. So I'd like yeah. to start in 1968 and give some meaning to his death. I'd like to see Lone Guard in Chicago during the riots. I'd like to take Lone Guard to Woodstock and let him see what happens in Woodstock. Remember the moon landings are coming up in,
yeah.
In 1969 and 70, the Kent State riots, and Watergate. I have a really incredible idea to do Dark Skies at Watergate that would be mind-blowing and would be the perfect. Let me put it this way. The people who understand the Dark Skies mythology about how we wind fact and fiction and UFOs and real live events together should understand that one of the best possible stories we can ever tell is Watergate. It'll be fascinating.
Yeah, indeed.
But on the other hand, to answer your question, I could very well sell the Dark Skies concept back to somebody and they'd say, "Well, okay, but let's not do this history thing. Why don't you start in present day?"
Right.
I really don't know. It's up to the powers that be and what they think would sell or not sell.
Ah, okay. Well, there was one aspect in there. I remember the series with the Beatles concert is being televised,
yes.
and everybody's waiting for it's a big, huge. I don't want to give too much away here, but mind control event basically to train
yes.
those people. This alludes to the MKUltra program and such. I guess that would be a continuation to look into at the Woodstock if Lone Guard goes there, huh?
Right. Well, I mean, let's face it. You know, there are some episodes we did just because we had to. You know, we said it is too much fun to not do a Beatles episode, and so we then built we said, well, what did the Beatles represent when they came to America? Well, they represented a live television event where everyone had their eyeballs on the TV set, which seemed like a pretty good problem in the Dark Skies universe. And one of the great fun things about doing Dark Skies was just that we literally, even though we had an overarching theme and a storyline that arced out over decades, each episode was very individualistic. One of them might be about the Beatles. One of them might, was about Vietnam. One of them was about the Civil Rights Movement.
Mm-hmm.
Another about the Kennedy assassination. So that's what I think made it fun for fans. They were able to just see how things that they already knew about were wrapped up into this counter universe. And the one thing that I will say that, I guess I bend over a little too far backwards to try to, put distance between the truth and the fiction aspect of
mm-hmm.
it. The one true thing that you could say that Dark Skies gets is the more global point of view, and that is, clearly, if UFOs exist at all, and that they have been here at all, then the world is not the same world that you think it is. That there are things going on that you simply don't get briefed on. And in that regard, Dark Skies is 100% true in that it's basically saying there is a whole other way to look at the society we live in if the UFO reality is true. And so it's not about whether you asked earlier what I believe or don't believe. It's not really about what I believe or don't believe. It's more about what the audience brings to it. Some people who are strong believers find a lot of really interesting material in there because we work very hard to put it in. But other people simply look at it as a great what if and a great piece of science fiction, which is the same as the book that Richard Dolan and I wrote. You know, some people who are not believers, I still tell them to read it because I say it's a good what if. Even if you know, the jury is still out for you and you haven't convinced yourself one way or the other, this book is still a good read because it gives you a chance to imagine a future where it is true.
Well, isn't that the point? I mean, no reason preaching to the choir, in a sense. I mean, we are speaking to potential newcomers or those who are undecided on the topic. Those who have closed off this possibility, there's nothing we can say or speak to them to open up their mind to this potential.
I mean, one of the things I do is I did this when I first started reading Richard Dolan's books. I bought multiple copies of them, and I would give them to friends who didn't know what to believe, and I'd say, please read it and give it back to me when you're done, and then I would give it to someone else. People have, you know, there are facts to be heard out there. Most people don't have the time or the interest in availing themselves of them. And then there's another thing. Some people just don't want to read a book like that because it's very uncomfortable for them to consider that it might be true. And I sort of come down from the point of view of, well, uncomfortable or not, if something is true, I'd like to know it.
Yeah, I agree.
That's just
of course.
My inclination. But then I have one other thing that the average person doesn't have, which is I can take in all kinds of theories and suppositions and use them dramatically without them having to rise to the level of truth. I guess what I'm bothered by is when I see people purporting certain things to be true that the journalistic work or the fact finding or the research hasn't been done on. I don't think that serves anybody. If something is as important as this might very well be, then it would seem to me that we all should have a higher standard in our non-dramatic telling of the story, but in our journalistic tellings and in our discussions with each other to hold ourselves to a higher standard of truth and accuracy.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I agree. And again, Dan, to wrap things up here, beginning anyway on the series and all that, all the details are not true. Don't look at it from that point of view. But again, the overarching picture gives you a really good, well, it's a crash course in the subject of ufology because it goes through all these high points, if you will, within it. So in that sense, for anyone who is a newcomer, I'd highly recommend the series. Just watch it and go through it because you get the background story on that time period right there very well. So good stuff.
I really appreciate you saying that because it's been such a joy to see new people be able to find it. And when they couldn't watch it all in a row back in the 90s because they didn't have DVRs and it was on Saturday nights here, and I don't know when it was on in various countries in Europe, it was just hard to get the whole series watched. I keep getting emails now from people who say that they bought the DVD set and they sat down and they were going to watch the pilot. They ended up watching all 20 hours over the weekend. And that makes me laugh and makes me very proud and makes me thankful to those people.
A good old marathon. That's how to do it. Yeah, that's right.
That's a very fun way to watch TV.
Why don't we shift over a little bit here? How did you come from this series over to Richard Dolan, his work? How did you guys hook up there?
Okay, well, let's just fill in one blank after Dark Skies in my respective chronology. After Dark Skies, I did work on the Taken miniseries with Steven Spielberg in the development phase.
Oh.
And you'll notice that Taken is almost like an homage to Dark Skies. When they finally did produce it, the pilot to Taken has Eric Close in it, who is my star on Dark Skies. It's produced by Stephen Beers, who produced my Dark Skies series. It's directed by Toby Hooper, who directed my Dark Skies pilot, and it had me working on the writing staff, and I created Dark Skies. So I look at Taken, and I have mixed feelings about it, obviously, because it is a little hard to watch their pilot where it's sort of Dark Skies redressed.
Yeah,
but that's the world we live in. Anyway, interesting experience. have always been interested in it, but after Taken, I took a little detour, as I said, to become the TV Academy chairman post 9/11, and that took me out of ufology certainly for quite a while. And then I sort of, you know, I can't say this is true for everybody, but it certainly is for me. There's a limit to how much you can take of the topic when you're deeply involved. It takes a price on you. And I found myself needing to take some years off from it.
Yeah.
Just to kind of get my head straight about things and to reassure myself that it wasn't the only thing that defined me, that I was also just a screenwriter and an executive at the TV Academy and things like that. Okay. Having gone through all that, after I got to the place where my appetite could be restored for the topic, because it's also hard to have a television series that you put your heart and soul into, like we did Dark Skies, get canceled, and then no one ever be able to see it because it's not out on DVD.
Yeah, I know.
So it was just hard, and I needed to kind of turn away. But I continued to read, and you know, Dolan's first book, UFOs in the National Security State, came out in 2000 and 2002, and then he had a second book come out, and I optioned those books. I called Richard. I didn't know Richard Dolan. I called him up and said, has anyone optioned the books that you've written? And he said, no. And I said, well, let me introduce myself. I'd like to do that. So we worked that out. And in terms of thinking about how they might become a television series of their own, Richard and I just started kicking around ideas. And I told him about this vision I had that for a book that was very future-oriented, that in fact did not look back historically but looked to the future about what would happen if this disclosure happened. And that also was something he'd been thinking a lot about. And so we decided to write a book about it. And the reason we decided to write the book is that we wanted to read the book, but nobody else had written it. So sometimes you have to write the book that you want to read.
You have to do it yourself.
Basically, what we did. And so for an entire year, we were working on it on Google Docs. He lives in New York. I live in Los Angeles. We would write on top of each other and edit each other. And more or less daily for about a four-month period, talk to each other about the ideas that would be contained within it. And it turned out to be an incredibly intellectually stimulating time. Because, as I said before, belief is not a requirement of reading the book, and it wasn't necessarily a requirement of writing it. You can look at this thing as only factual, or you could look at it for the people who haven't availed themselves of doing much reading in the area. They could read this book that Richard and I wrote and simply look at it as a what-if, as if they'd gone to a movie for the night. But what we were most setting out to do was to, in a way, write what the Rand Corporation might have written as a report to prepare somebody for what might happen. We simply said, there's been like 5,000 books that have been written trying to prove UFOs are real, but we didn't feel writing the 5,000 and first would make much difference, especially since Richard was already deeply in the middle of his trilogy, UFOs in the National Security State. So we wrote the book nobody else had ever written. And in order to make it a separate contribution, I must say, Richard caught some flack for that because he actually diverted his attention from finishing up his trilogy and writing the third part of UFOs in the National Security State in order to co-author AD After Disclosure with me. Some people, you know, obviously are waiting to read that third and final volume, and I think there's been enough time now that Richard is hard at work at that. Our book, by the way, and I don't know what the situation is in Europe. I know it's available in Europe, and it's certainly you can purchase it. Here in the United States, it's just come out, and we have a major book chain here called Barnes & Noble, and I don't know if that's in Europe. Is it?
Maybe it's in the UK. I'm actually uncertain about that. It's not in Sweden.
It's like our major, you know, book chains are in terrible retreat right now.
Yeah.
The e-books and so forth.
Yeah.
But Barnes & Noble is the main one that's existed and has survived. And for the next 2 months here in the United States, when you walk into a Barnes & Noble, our book is on the front entry table under the new and noteworthy books. So that's heartening. And it also, I think, shows that the buyers at Barnes & Noble have obviously decided that this transcends the genre. It's not It's not something that needs to be relegated to the New Age stacks, but that it's something that a general purpose audience might want to see.
Absolutely. It is in the UK. I just found that out. It's in even in Germany, and there's some places randomly here and there in Europe. So, yeah.
I wish it was in different languages. If this version of it succeeds, I'm sure it will be, and that's my hope.
Now, when we take a little break here in about 10 minutes or so, I want to get into the nitty and gritty of things in the second segment here. But what is, since this is a new version or edition coming out here, what's is there new stuff added to it? Is it changed or updated? Tell us about that.
Let me just give you the history. Richard and I put out a hardcover version of AD After Disclosure through his publishing company, Keyhole Publishing, in late 2010. And we sold out our first printing, and then we sold out our second printing. So we were pretty confident that we had a book that had a message that people wanted to read. So we asked our book agent, John White, to explore whether someone else wanted to take it out to the wider global market, someone who had a better and more complete distribution system. So he found Career Press and New Page Books out of New York, and they were very interested in it. And they have put out this latest version. And yes, it is different. I would say that the people who read the first hardcover book, I don't want to take anyone's dollars that they don't want to give. They don't have to go buy this next one. But this version is different in that we took the time to edit it down to make it clearer. We added references to events that had happened since the first version came out. And we worked hard just to straighten out its logic and its reasoning so that it was just a better ride or a better read even. And I think we succeeded in that. So it's hard to say. I can hardly say that it is a completely brand new book. It is not. But it is enough different that it's very accessible. It's a fast read, but it's a mind-blowing read now. I mean, by the end of it, your mind has been expanded.
I agree. I have a copy of the first one, and I totally agree. I want to get into and ask you about some of the stuff within the book here later then. But about a year ago, we had Richard with us, of course, as well. We talked about the book and kind of picked his brain on the subject. I want to do the same with you and see, I guess, what some of the differences and what your angle has been to this, what you bring to the table, I guess, in that sense. Richard obviously have a historical background in this. He's been looking at the history, and hence for him, it's maybe a little bit easier, perhaps, to project ahead into the future, to look into a plausible outcome of events if this would indeed unfold. How did you approach the subject, Bryce?
Well, I don't know. I actually think Richard felt that he was stretching more than I felt I was stretching, because I kept pushing us to be more specific and definitive about some of these changes that might occur. I think, and then we both came to embrace the concept that we should be very bold. We shouldn't write a safe book. We should write a book that had a lot of very specific and controversial, if necessary, applications to it. And I do think that we provided a very interesting merging. But remember, Richard is rock solid on the history and on the cases. And he's a terrific partner for that. And I'm a guy that is also comfortable in taking research and facts and blending them into a dramatic story. And so what we felt was, since we were not talking in AD After Disclosure about what happened before, but what might happen, that seemed like a natural place for us to both merge our talents. And just in case your listeners are wondering, when we call it AD After Disclosure, we mean to say that the public revelation that at least some of these objects that are flying around in the sky are from some place that isn't here, and they're piloted by somebody that isn't us. That, for us, is basic disclosure. It's as simple as it could be. And from the moment that that happens from some kind of public persona, whether it be a president, a pope, a prime minister, Chinese premier, the minute somebody in an officialdom actually utters some kind of statement such as that, we think it's the equivalent of the calendar change going back to the birth of Christ. Because we think that everything that we're living in now is the BC world, the before confirmation world. But from the moment a public utterance is made to confirm that some of these craft and some of these cases are authentic and unexplainable through our own earthly machinations, then we switch our own calendar over from BC before confirmation to AD after disclosure, because it's going to be an incredibly relevant dividing point for our current society. And so that's why we chose the title, and that's why the book, if you think about it, all the other UFO books that have been written exist in the BC world, the before confirmation world.
Yeah.
This is the first one that talks about the AD world totally. So we're, you know, to answer your question, I think what Richard and I realized was that the two of us together were smarter than just one of us on this topic. And so we kept asking ourselves very basic questions like, well, who would make such an announcement? Under what conditions would they make it? When would they make it? What would it say? How would it change the institutions that govern our global society right now? And we came to the conclusion that it would change all of them. It's a transformative event of major implications. And even though we're not saying it's going to be panic in the streets by any means, it doesn't have to be like the War of the Worlds, it does transform things. And it doesn't have to be a violent transformation, but it will be a transformation. If you think about the history books that exist currently, if someone were to confirm the reality of Roswell, well, that would require most history books written since that time to have a slight reference to that.
That's true.
So people would be busy rewriting.
Yeah. Now, how symbolic do you think it is also with the play on the idea that this is about a new age in a sense? The calendars are in there. We're talking about potential religion being under threat. We've seen the Vatican obviously kind of trying to adjust to a certain degree to this topic. I mean, are we talking about the end of Christianity and a reset button back to zero again, do you think?
I don't think so. It's interesting. People always bring up religion almost first because it's been almost universally assumed, and I put the emphasis on the assumed assumption part of that. It's been assumed that the people who will freak out most after disclosure would be the religious community.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not what the facts seem to state. Richard and I did look into that, and we write an entire chapter about the science and religion and how it will be changed. Both institutions will be transformed. But if you interview religious people from all the world's different religions and ask them what they would do if it turned out that there were other intelligent life forms besides humans out there, how it would affect them, most religious people don't seem to have any problem with it. Their attitude seems to be God is great, God is universal, the universe is a big place, and God might have many children out there, and humans might have brothers and sisters out there. So they didn't seem to care as much. Now, what's interesting is you go to those same polls and say, well, who does think then that the religious community will freak out? Overwhelmingly, the people who think the religious community will freak out are atheists and agnostics.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the great joys of researching this with an intellectually vigorous mind like Richard Dolan's is that when we kicked it back and forth, we really tried to ask ourselves, just because somebody thinks something is true doesn't make it true. Is there a way that we should be looking at this that would be a more accurate revelation of how it might go down? One of the things we found to be extremely helpful in writing the book was not to look at UFO cases from the past, but to look at how society has dealt with certain things from the past and see if they could be applied to a post-disclosure environment. I'll give you one example. In a post-disclosure environment, obviously, most people in Congress will have heard nothing about this. You know, they haven't been briefed. They don't know anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
And if a disclosure were to happen, you can bet that Congress would decide to have hearings because it would give them a chance to look like they were in charge and they could grandstand at congressional hearings. And we think that the Watergate hearings from 1973 and then the impeachment hearings in 1974 would be instructive. The Watergate hearings, we had a senator named Sam Ervin who asked every witness, what did you know and when did you know it? And that seems to me to be something that a congressman or a senator could easily ask people in hearings about an extraterrestrial reality. What did you know about it? When did you know it? Who told you? Those kind of questions. Another way we might end up handling this would be if you think about how South Africa dealt with the end of apartheid, they had to have a national healing because obviously, for obvious reasons, and they had truth and reconciliation commissions that traveled their country. We might need to do that worldwide because obviously some people who will have withheld information from the rest of us. And whatever that information is, people like to know the truth. We always have. We're always truth seekers. That's what humans are. So when we realize that somebody kept it from us, we will need to be healed of that. And it may very well be that we need to go hear people tell their story. And there's no guarantee that the disclosure happens in one fell swoop. It may very well be that there's a need to have commissions because we have to dig the truth out a little bit at a time.
Absolutely. Very interesting. There's just so many components to this that I want to break down and talk more with you about here in the second segment. We're going to take a little break here right now.
Okay,
I want to give out the websites again, of course, for people. Facebook.com/Dark Skies UFO for more on the reboot on the excellent series. And then, of course, if you haven't already gotten a copy of AD After Disclosure, you can head on over to afterdisclosure.com and pick it up there, or Amazon, or any other of the major bookstores, as Bryce mentioned. Much more to talk about here in the next segment, Bryce. So this has been really good. Stay with us. We'll be right back with more.
Imagination is funny. It makes a cloudy day sunny. Makes a bee think of honey, just as I think of you. Imagination is crazy. Your whole perspective gets hazy. Starts you asking a daisy what to do, what to do. Have you ever felt a gentle touch and then a kiss and then find it's only your imagination again? Oh well, imagination is silly. You go
for our members. Bryce talks about his new book, co-authored with Richard Doland. It seems inevitable that one day the U.S. government or another government around the world will reveal the existence of UFOs, ETs, and alien contact to the rest of the world, whatever they may be. In the book AD After Disclosure, Bryce Sable and Richard Doland describes in detail the various scenarios that are possible in a new world where our cosmic neighbors are openly acknowledged. So, in this second hour, we're going to examine many what-if scenarios and discuss the mechanics and different possibilities. Will disclosure lead to social panic, chaos, and the breakdown of religion? Or will it usher in a new era of unity, peace, and new technology? Either way, it's a game-changing event. Continue listening as we discuss the various scenarios with Bryce Sable.
Acquire a membership and continue listening to this or any of our previous programs. We provide you with an investigative radio program on a myriad of topics without commercial interruptions and an ad-free website. By the way, we have some really interesting programs coming up next on Red Ice Radio, our Olympic special with William Henry, Stuart Swerdlow, Chad Stemke, Bob Schlenker, and many more. After this, we have Courtney Brown, Birgitta Jonsdottir, Kevin Annette, Jan Irvin, Duncan Worley, Joseph Atwill and Fritz Heed, Joseph Farrell, Linda Moltenhau, Rosa Corey, Walter Burian, and many more coming on the program. But right now, Hour 2 with Bryce Sable is up next. Stay with us.